From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, the Senate is debating the future of immigration, including the Dreamers. Republicans and Democrats are floating ideas that could eventually be cobbled together into something that they can pass. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who caucuses with the Democrats, joins me now. Senator, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And we know what President Trump wants in his immigration plan. Four pillars: money to build a wall, a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, an end to the visa lottery, and limits on chain migration, also known as family reunification. If a plan comes out of the Senate that has all of those parts, would you support it?
No. I think what the American people are very clear about, close to 90%, is they want to make sure that the Dreamers in this country get legal status and they get a path towards citizenship. And by the way, most Americans do not think it makes a whole lot of sense to be spending billions of dollars on a wall. So for a start, I think we should do what the American people want us to do. We have a few days, just a few days, to deal with this great moral crisis. And in my view, what we should be doing is focusing on two issues. Number one, a path towards citizenship and providing legal status for the 1.8 million people who are eligible for DACA. And number two, we should improve border security. And we can do that in a more cost-effective way than by spending billions on a wall that we really don't need.
But would a wall be something that would stop you from supporting a path to citizenship for the Dreamers?
Well, I don't want to speculate on what the final product will be. What I can tell you is there is a strong majority of members here in the Senate, I'm guessing 56, 57 members, Democrats all and some Republicans, who think that the focus should be on legal status for the Dreamers and a path towards citizenship and border security, not getting into other areas. I hope that's where we will go. And I can tell you also that there is a majority in the House who support that. And I would very much appreciate Speaker Ryan allowing the House to have a vote on what the members there want.
But do you think that there's a majority in the House or a majority in the Senate even who would pass that pathway to citizenship for Dreamers without the things that President Trump wants?
Yes, I do. I think in terms of border security, that has to be part of the program. How much you spend on a wall that I think is unnecessary is another story. But I do believe there is a majority in the Senate. We're trying to get 60 votes for people to say, let us focus on making sure that the Dreamers have legal protection and a path towards citizenship. Let's deal with border security. There is strong support both in the House and the Senate for going forward. Broader comprehensive immigration reform, something that we should be looking at. But between you and me, it is not going to be resolved in 3 days.
Do you think that the issue of the Dreamers will be resolved before the deadline in March?
I certainly hope so. Let me, be very clear. This, to me, is a profound moral issue. Because if we are not successful, what could happen is that 800,000 young people who have spent their entire lives in this country, who know no other country other than the United States, could be subject to deportation. And that would be just an absolute outrage that we must not allow to happen.
You were in a budget hearing this morning. We're hearing a lot of details of President Trump's budget. Should Americans be worried that Medicare is going to face cuts?
Of course they should. And they should be worried that you have an administration that worked overtime to provide massive tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations. And you have a president who, when he ran for office, told the American people he wasn't going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Well, it turns out that he is proposing over $1 trillion cuts to Medicaid, hundreds of billions of dollars cuts to Medicare, and cuts to the disability program within Social Security. Our job is to make sure that those cuts do not happen. You got people in this country who are struggling every day to pay their health care costs, which are rising, and we do not need to be throwing millions of people off of the health insurance they have or to making it more difficult for people on Medicare to get the health care they need.
Do you think those cuts will actually happen?
No, I don't. I don't. I think, by and large, most of what the president is proposing will go nowhere.
One more thing. There's been a hearing going on today on Capitol Hill with the top intelligence officials. And again, Russian meddling in the election has come up, and they've said that there is already Russian meddling going on in the 2018 elections in this country. Are you confident, Senator, that the U.S. is doing enough to stop that from happening?
No, I am absolutely not confident about that. The president's own head of the CIA has indicated that Russia meddled in 2016. And he worries about 2018. But you have a president who is, I guess, accepting what Mr. Putin said when he met with Putin. And Putin said, hey, we didn't do anything. And the president said, well, I believe him. Well, I don't believe Putin. I think the evidence is overwhelming that the Russians did meddle significantly in 2016. I have zero reason to believe that they're not going to do it again in 2018. We are not prepared. There's no question that we are not prepared at the state level, at the local level, and at the federal level. And the president has got to understand what's going on and help us address this very, very serious attack on our democracy.
What should we be doing?
Well, for sure, we should be making sure that in every community in America that votes cannot be tampered with. If I cast the vote, that vote is counted and that it is not manipulated. And then second of all, we obviously have got to deal with the cyber warfare, where there's a massive amount of lies and misinformation and fake news that are going to people throughout this country coming from Russia.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Take care.
There's a new federal mandate that requires truckers in the U.S. to electronically track the number of hours they spend driving. The tracking is meant to make highways safer. But truck drivers who haul livestock say it could put the animals at risk, and it could also lead to higher prices for meat. Ben Kiebrick from Harvest Public Media reports.
Austin Streckvis loads about 80 cattle onto a truck after a livestock auction in Dodge City, Kansas. He'll soon drive them to Meade, 45 miles away. Livestock haulers like Streckvist have a temporary exemption from the new law that requires electronic logging devices, or ELDs, to be installed in 18-wheelers. The ELDs record when a truck is driven, replacing fungible paper records, and holding truckers to their hours of service, limiting the overall workday and the time spent behind the wheel. If Streckvist had an ELD today, his clock would have started when he drove his truck to the sale barn hours ago, and it would have been ticking as he sat around waiting for the auction to end.
It's going to definitely put a halt on a lot of things. It's going to make the industry tough to deal with.
Streckvist's boss, Steve Hilker, explains.
What an ELD does, if that driver's 4 hours away from his destination and he's got 3 hours and 20 minutes left on his countdown clock that's right there on his dash, what's he going to do? He's going to take maybe chances he shouldn't take to make that delivery so he's not stuck for 10 hours 20 miles away.
Hilker says ELDs will limit livestock haulers' flexibility.
There's never been any consideration that we haul a living, breathing commodity. When a driver reaches his maximum hours on duty, he has to stop for 10 hours unbroken. All right, well, what are we doing with these cattle, hogs, bees, fish? Well, what are we going to do with them?
He says there aren't places to unload animals while drivers rest, which is especially important if it's hot out. And even if there were, the sites would have to be kept clean so they wouldn't spread disease. Plus, research shows that loading and unloading is extremely stressful on the animals, not to mention a lot of work. Truckers who are opposed to electronic logging devices have a Facebook group with over 23,000 members. Republican Congressman Brian Babin of Texas mentioned the social media movement on the House floor late last year.
Millions of American truckers are pleading 24/7 for relief from this mandate using the hashtag ELD or me.
But the Department of Transportation estimates ELDs could prevent 1,800 crashes and 26 deaths each year. And Sean McNally with the American Trucking Association, which represents the interests of mostly larger trucking companies, says ELDs are going to make the industry more efficient.
What we hear from our members is when they made the transition from paper to electronic, they had pushback from their drivers. Their drivers were like, I don't want that in my truck. Once they were required to, the attitude flips 180 degrees. It's, you can't take that away from me. I refuse to go back to paper logs.
Steve Hilker in Kansas says, aside from possibly having to follow the 11-hour driving limit and 14-hour workdays like the rest of truckers, there'd be other concerns for livestock haulers because they can't leave their livestock on trucks overnight.
It's going to take more equipment to move the same number of livestock. It'll take more people. We're already woefully short on qualified drivers.
That means higher transportation costs. Dwayne Hund, a cattle rancher and director of the Farm Analyst Program at Kansas State University, says he'd have to hire a second driver to take over halfway through a delivery.
It's probably going to cost us at least another $500 per load. You're taking potentially 10% of the profit.
Ag economists say some of that extra cost will be passed on to consumers in the form of more expensive meat at the grocery store. The livestock industry has asked the Department of Transportation to consider its unique needs, and quickly, because its temporary exemption is only good until March 18th. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Kiebrick.
Ben's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues. Alzheimer's disease unravels the mind. It can tear apart the fabric of families, and it costs this nation billions of dollars, $260 billion a year. For two decades now, scientists have been studying how immunotherapies may treat the disease. The theory is that antibodies might trigger the brain to destroy a kind of protein that clumps in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. The clumps are known as beta-amyloid plaques. Recently, some large clinical trials of that kind of immunotherapy have failed. And an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine says researchers may be, quote, nearing the end of the amyloid hypothesis rope. Dr. Risa Sperling says, not yet. Sperling is a leading Alzheimer's researcher. She directs a center at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and she is forging ahead to study the treatment of amyloid plaques because she thinks the key is to catch the disease earlier.
We've been testing these drugs when the amyloid's already been in the brain for 10 or 20 years, rather than testing it at the time that the buildup is happening.
So you have a comparison with statins that lower cholesterol.
Absolutely. So if we give a statin to someone who's in the cardiac ICU with significant heart damage, it's very unlikely we can do much. But by giving statins to lower cholesterol before someone has a heart attack or before they have a stroke, we've changed dramatically cardiac disease. We need to do that in Alzheimer's disease by finding people who have amyloid plaque buildup but don't yet have the symptoms and irreversible brain damage in Alzheimer's disease.
So you have a study that's going on right now that you've actually adjusted because of the failures of some of the pharmaceutical companies that have given up on this amyloid hypothesis. What are you doing differently?
Yes, the A4 study is in people who don't yet have symptoms of Alzheimer's disease but do show evidence of the amyloid plaque buildup. And one of the changes we made on the basis of these disappointing results at later stages is to go earlier in people who don't yet have symptoms, but also to increase the dose. Because I think we're left...
I'm sorry, dose of?
The dose of the drug that we're giving to try to help the brain clear out the amyloid. This is an antibody that helps the brain clear out the amyloid as it's building up in the plaques. We quadrupled the dose in the A4 study.
This is recently.
Very recently, just over the past few months. And the reason for that is that we don't want to be left again yet with yet another study where the question is, was it too little or too late? We don't yet know if amyloid's the right target. I agree with the skepticism in the field, but I feel like we have to give it an adequate test.
The quest for a treatment or a cure for Alzheimer's is urgent. The progress has so far been glacial or stagnant. Why don't we yet have a treatment or a way to delay Alzheimer's, never mind a cure?
Alzheimer's disease is a very complex disorder that very likely involves multiple different components. So part of it's just that it's a slowly, inevitably progressive disorder, and we only know parts of what might be involved. But secondly, I think we've been looking at Alzheimer's disease at the end stage of the disease rather than looking at the beginnings of the disease and the risk factors. And that's what I hope the A4 study and other prevention trials are doing now. But also, I would say we haven't thrown enough resources at Alzheimer's disease. Until recently, we were spending about one-tenth on Alzheimer's disease.
Why is
that? Cancer. I think partly because Alzheimer's disease was thought of as an old person's disease. Now that people are living longer and that we realize that Alzheimer's disease affects people in their 60s and 70s, and we really need to be thinking about this as a public health emergency. Very fortunately, last year, I think exactly what you're saying finally got to Congress. So for the first time in a very long time, there was an increase in Alzheimer's funding, about $400 million, which made a tremendous difference already. I realize there's many pressures on the research, but Alzheimer's disease is a public health emergency. And for those who are looking at the fiscal balance, Alzheimer's disease could bankrupt Medicare. And so if we don't start thinking about an ounce of prevention, we are really going to be in trouble, because every bit of research we do now can really benefit us financially as a country later.
What's the most promising finding on the horizon?
One of the most exciting things is being able to look at the underlying changes in the brain before there are symptoms. So not just the amyloid plaques, but now we can see these tangles that form inside the nerve cells. And for the first time, we can see that the amyloid plaques and the tau tangles are related even before people have symptoms. We can now use that to actually say, if we lower amyloid, can we change the tangles? And most importantly, from my point of view, get to combination therapies, where we're treating not just one of the processes, but several together, just like we do in cancer and heart disease.
So for those people listening who are frightened that this will affect somebody in their family or affect them, what can they do?
Well, certainly there are lifestyle things that are important, a healthy diet, exercise. Certainly eating a heart-healthy diet is good for your brain. And I think one of the things people can do is come and volunteer for a clinical trial.
You can make your pitch now.
I believe that the cure, or at least an effective treatment for Alzheimer's disease, is likely in someone's test tube right now. And the bottleneck is getting these trials enrolled. We need thousands of volunteers to join us, both people who are already suffering from Alzheimer's disease symptoms, but especially people who have a family history but are still cognitively normal.
Dr. Sperling, how do you protect your brain?
Well, I try to go to dance class two or three times a week, because I am convinced by exercise that may have some protective effects. And I would say that the thing I do most is to try to stay engaged and feel like my life has a purpose. And I hope that some of the work we're doing in Alzheimer's disease will benefit me in time, because I have a very strong family risk. But mostly, I hope it's going to protect my daughters.
Dr. Sperling, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Risa Sperling directs the Center for Alzheimer Research and Treatment at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. To find out more, go to hereandnow.org. And this note about the flu. It's been widespread this season, with about 17,000 people hospitalized for flu-related illness since October. This is costing businesses billions. The consulting firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas estimates that 25 million Americans will miss at least 4 days of work because either they have the flu or somebody in their family does. And that costs the economy about $21 billion in lost productivity. One of life's pleasures is travel. And one of the most popular places to travel is Venice, Italy. But don't be fooled. That voice is not coming from the canals of Venice, but from a lake in Oakland, California. To celebrate Valentine's Day a little bit early, KQED's Chloe Veltman set out with her boyfriend Jim on a romantic adventure in a gondola and met a gondolier who finds singing to lovebirds a mixed blessing.
You're looking forward to this romantic joyride on Lake Merritt, Jim?
I am. I've been practicing my singing and my smooching.
Jim and I have been dating for nearly 3 years. On a beautiful Saturday afternoon, we head towards the boathouse and meet gondolier Zoltan Di Bartolo.
You're going to want to step with your left foot first on the top stair and just walk down the center.
All right.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes.
As we push out into the glassy water, Di Bartolo tells me he really loves his job.
Just couldn't be more happy to be out here on a boat. Fresh air, it's exercise, and it's singing, which is all my body really wants to do.
This former lounge singer fell in love with opera. He performs with companies around the Bay Area. He also has a special place in his heart for Lake Merritt. Even if paddling around the man-made lagoon in the center of Oakland isn't quite the same as navigating the world-famous Italian canals.
do you think this Lake Merritt has the romance and glamour of Venice?
Maybe with enough champagne.
And as if on cue, my boyfriend pops a cork. The singing gondolier lets rip with another of his favourite romantic arias.
Negli occhi suoi spunto.
And we share a toast.
Cheers, sweetheart.
And a kiss.
That's why I like my job.
You make the people want to kiss each other.
I make the people kiss.
But sometimes Di Bartolo's customers are deaf to the tenor's sensual serenade. Like the couple he ferried around recently, who spent the whole ride glued to their cell phones.
They just had their faces buried. I sang them a few songs, and at one point they looked up and said, "Hey, nice singing." I ended up just starting to check my emails too.
After we dock, I asked Di Bartolo why he thinks gondola rides are so romantic.
It's like you're being rocked like a babe in arms. Someone's singing. And it makes people feel held and safe and perhaps more vulnerable.
His answer catches me off guard. As the sun sinks in a blur of purples and pinks behind the downtown skyline, I think about the fragility of the bond that lovers share. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman in Oakland.
Per poco a suoi sospir.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Palpiti sentir. Confondere i miei coi suoi sospir. Cielo si può morir, di più non chiedo, non chiedo.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Could oil prices be heading for a big drop? The International Energy Agency reported this week that booming oil production in the U.S. is, quote, reminiscent of the growth in shale that came right before a big crash in prices in 2014. So let's look at what's happening with Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Jeremy.
You too. And the price of Brent crude is around $62 today, yep, which is a decent drop from the end of January when it was up at $70 a barrel. What's going on?
Well, so, you know, OPEC countries, it's a 14-member cartel. They're always loath to reduce their output, reduce production, because if they do that, they know that the price of oil will go up, but they'll sell less of it. They finally decided to do that. And as they do this, we've seen this movie before, as they drop production and prices go up, it becomes more valuable for American shale oil producers. America has gone from a net oil importing country into a massive exporting country and is poised to become the biggest exporter in the entire world. So where OPEC is putting out less oil, where we were seeing prices go up, Americans are coming into the market and causing oil prices to go down. Generally good, because A, we're getting more American energy workers into the game, and lower energy prices are, you know, good for consumers.
But the IEA said this week that the oil glut produced by OPEC countries is almost cleared.
That's right.
Is that going to help relieve any oversupply?
Yeah, well, that's what the issue is, right? One has to think of oil in terms of volatility. It's not like the stock market that sort of gradually should be going up on an ongoing basis. Oil is about volatility. When the prices are high, more people produce, then we get a glut, we get too much production, which is what we saw with U.S. shale oil a few years back. Then the prices plummet and it goes down below a price. So you need to think of oil as sort of like a $55 to $60 a barrel range is what makes it profitable for U.S. shale oil producers. If oil is running below $55 a barrel, you're going to see companies get out of the business. If it's 55 to 60 or above, as it is now, you'll see American oil players get in. So that's what we have to watch for. If OPEC gets tired of this, it'll cut more oil out. But, you know, it's back and forth. When prices are high, more people produce. When prices are low, fewer people produce.
Now, we mentioned 2014, there was a drop in prices, which was not about the stock market. But the last time before that oil prices really plummeted,
it was
tied with the financial crisis. How does last week's drop in the stock market factor into what's happening with oil?
Probably very little, because right now there is this cat and mouse game going on with production between OPEC and America. Mm. So that's the main thing. But generally speaking, a large percentage of the recessions in the past are often spurred by a spike in oil prices, and sometimes it works in concert with stock market moves. This is one time that it's not. It's not particularly related to the stock market move. It's not that people are moving into or out of oil because they see other investment opportunities. This really has to do with the glut, the right. overproduction, and then the resulting underproduction.
Just a few seconds left here, Ali, but there's a well-being index, an annual survey by Gallup of the emotional, social, and health status of residents in all 50 states, and it's down in a lot of states.
It is down. It's had a big drop. It's the largest year-over-year decline in the index since it began in 2006. There are a lot of things at play here. One thing it doesn't measure is the opioid epidemic, which some experts are saying may have played a role into this, because this is an epidemic that's growing, not shrinking. But we're still digging in to see what that is. But yeah, decline for the biggest decline we've seen.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you. Let's take a few minutes now for a cello edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Terrence McKnight is a DJ and evening host on WQXR in New York and joins us now. Terrence, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And by the way, I played that suite when I was a kid. I was a cellist, and that's one of the main things that you can play just with the cello, the Bach suites. Yeah,
are your palms still sweating from playing?
Yeah, absolutely.
All those memories.
Well, and tell us a little bit about the cello.
Well, you know, the cello came about when Johann Sebastian Bach came about. It was developed around 1660, so he was, a young man born in 1685. So, you know, as most good composers would want to do, is write for a new instrument that's out in the streets, you know, the best player you can get your hands on. And that's what Sebastian Bach did.
Well, and the cello has such a unique sound, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, and, you know, a lot of people will say that the cello really represents the human soul. You know, it's the instrument that most closely vibrates with our own vibration. So it's the soul of the orchestra, some will say.
All right, well, let's get to some of the music for cello that you brought us. This is Seven Tunes Heard in China, Movement 5, Diu Diu Dong. It's written by Bright Sheng and performed by Alyssa Weilerstein. Some of those notes sound high enough to be played on a violin, but you can tell that they're not. It's a cello.
And what Bright Sheng is doing, he's allowing the cello to sound like an erhu. It really sounds like that Chinese instrument. And I think, you know, there again, here you have a composer really showing the range of that cello, man, an instrument that, you know, didn't grow up in China, but here you have it, you know, playing his music and sounding very authentic.
And what should we know about Bright Sheng?
Composer who came to the States in the 80s and won a lot of awards, has written a lot for orchestra, has written for Chinese instruments, and his music is often a combination of Western and Eastern influences.
All right, well, next we have Glenn Cochee's 20-minute piece, Something of Life. This is performed by Jeffrey Ziegler. So tell us what's going on here.
Jeff Ziegler played in the Kronos Quartet for a number of years, and this is his first project. After leaving the group, he wanted to explore some of his own music and be back in New York. And there you have his first solo record in which he's playing to a track. So Glenn Cochee, who's very affiliated with that band Wilco, and he's a drummer. And so he's created this track where Jeff, again, is showing, you know, what a solo cellist can do and how he's able to incorporate sounds of the street, sounds of everyday life.
And sounds of the street, it actually sounds like he's outside.
It is, man. It sounds like kids in the playground and people speaking. And you mentioned this long piece is about 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. So you really get a sense of a large community and all the diversity in that community. As Jeff, it sounds like he's walking or venturing through his community.
Okay, next we have the composer Philip Glass's piece, The Secret Agent for Solo Cello. This is performed by Matt Heimovitz. Just beautiful to listen to. What do you like about this one?
I mean, you get a similar passion that you get in something like Sebastian Bach's suites. Mm-hmm. You get the sense of that perpetual movement that you get in Baroque music. So, and you get a language that is not very, how can I say, progressive, but it's a very simplistic harmonic language. And Philip Glass really makes the most out of that sort of minimalism.
Yeah, it's interesting because Philip Glass is known for writing these big operas and orchestral movie scores, and now here he is just doing something for solo cello.
Yeah, but that actually comes from a 1996 film where he wrote a soundtrack called The Secret Agent. I think you're spot on talking about his operas because you get the passion, the beauty that comes out of those operas. He gets it. Matt brings it out in that piece for solo cello.
All right, the next one is O Virtus Sapientiae. For cello and electronics, I hope I said that right. It's written by Hildegard von Bingen and performed here by Maya Beiser. So dramatic. And by the way, this was originally written for three voices.
Yeah, and Maya, you know, she often uses, you know, her instrument and electronics. She'll use a set, you know, there will be a whole dramatic thing to her performances. And she's got a new project coming out, but I wanted to show that and hear that because she's going back to Hildegard, who was, you know, a mystic and a playwright, and she was writing music way before Johann Sebastian Bach. We're going back to the Renaissance, and here's Maya bringing her music forward, and I think it's a great time to really highlight some of the women who are working in this field and writing for cello and playing cello. And so that was part of my thinking in this, Jeremy.
And what are the electronics doing?
Sometimes they mimic. Sometimes there's a call and response happening with the electronics. So it gives her a chance to sort of, I guess, speak to herself and to the audience at the same time. So it's very interactive.
Well, we are going to end this segment sort of where we started, which is with the Bach suites. This is Bach's Cello Suite number 2 in D minor, Movement 1, performed by Pablo Casals. The memories are coming back to me. But why are the Bach suites so well known when it comes to cello music?
You know, I think because Bach was so early in approaching the solo cello work, and, you know, he really, it seems, man, he put his soul into it, and, you know, his music speaks from across generations, across, you know, culture, across time, because it goes from one heart to another heart, and I think that that's beyond all of those things. And for that reason, we've been listening to it for 300 years.
Did you play the cello?
Yeah, I was more of a trumpet guy.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, yeah. See, that would have been, I think, a lot harder. Do you think that that's the case?
Well, maybe next time.
Terrence McKnight, DJ and evening host on WQXR in New York. Thank you so much, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Afghanistan has a mental health crisis that's been fueled by war. The World Health Organization says that more than 1 million Afghans suffer from depressive disorders, and there are few options for treatment. The country has only one secure psychiatric facility. Many of the patients there are chained and sedated. Some say they should be allowed to leave.
I'm not crazy. I swear I'm not. This place is for crazy people.
As the voice of an interpreter, the BBC's Sahar Zan traveled to this facility in Afghanistan. Sahar, where is it and who is being held there?
This psychiatric institution is in Herat, western Afghanistan. The people, the patients inside it, there are about 300 patients, and they're from all over Afghanistan, and they come from all sorts of different walks of life. The majority of people are actually in there because they have developed psychological problems during the war because of Afghanistan's recent history. Even thinking about it now, it still sends shivers down my spine. Is the fact that they're actually not cured, but good to go. I mean, they, as long as they take their medication, they would no longer be a threat to the society. I mean, that's the type of people who are in there. But for these patients to get discharged, somebody needs to come and pick them up. Somebody needs to take over from the institution. Now, let's look at the recent history. For nearly 40 years, there's been a war, a conflict going on, and 2 million people have died. So a lot of these patients, they've lost all their family in war. And a big proportion of Afghans have migrated to neighboring countries like Iran, Pakistan, and a lot of them, you know, elsewhere in the world. I mean, a lot of the patients in there don't have any family member in Afghanistan to come and pick them up. And without anyone picking them up, they're just stuck in there.
They're stuck in there because they have no kind of agency of their own. There has to be someone to take them home. Are they capable of living on their own if they get out?
No, they're not capable of living on their own. That's the thing. And they basically, the institution needs to make sure that these patients are actually, once they're discharged, they have a roof over their head, their medication is being taken, somebody's looking after them, so they don't end up in the same sort of state that they were in before they were sent in there.
And the state is like a state of anxiety, a state of physical distress, violence?
Patients who are in there, they're in there because they suffer from severe psychological problems like psychosis, schizophrenia, severe PTSD, and they've really lost control and, you know, they were a threat to the society when they were outside. And without anyone to take over, they're basically stuck in there forever.
you met, and we should say that many of the people who were there, I was going to call them inmates because it looks like they're inmates, even though they're they're patients. But many of them are outside in a big courtyard. And there are two men who used to be enemies on the battlefield. One of them is a former Taliban fighter. The other one was on the other side with the Mujahideen. They're actually chained together. And let's just listen to a little bit of sound from your report. First, we hear from the man who once fought for the Taliban, and then the other man.
The Taliban are very good people. They are the men of Islam.
That's rubbish. They are radicals and force their version of Islam on people.
You are crazy. You don't know what you're talking about.
No, I'm not crazy. I'm perfectly fine.
I mean, these are two men that sound like they could be together talking on a street corner. They're chained together in this facility. What's going on there?
It was just bizarre because they were, I mean, they would spend every day together. They've been chained together since they were brought in about a year ago. And all they do all day is sit down and argue about the different mentality that they have. I mean, it's literally the opposite. But what's really interesting and is the fact that on the face of it, these two men are so different, are the complete opposites. But when we look past the Taliban or the Mujahid label, they're both essentially victims of a conflict, of a war that led them being in the institution. They're both fathers. They're both middle age. I mean, they're both called Muhammad and they're both Afghan men. They were fighting for their beliefs. And the conflict led to them having long-term psychological problems. No matter who you are, where you come from, what your religion, ideology, race, whatever is, war is ugly. And it doesn't just leave behind destroyed buildings or corpses. It leaves behind a long-term effect on people's minds. And this is something that gets passed down generations and can actually have very long-term horrific effects. They're intangible, so we don't really see them. We think once war is over somewhere, then it's all, you know, nice and people are all happy. But that's not the case. If we are more aware of the long-term problems that comes with war, then perhaps we would look at war and conflict slightly differently. How often do we actually sit down and think, how are we going to deal with this trauma that people are left with? Buildings get built, yes, but there is so much more that we need to fix. And in my film, I only touched upon a tiny, tiny aspect of it. There is so much more that we don't even know of.
Well, thank you for your work. The BBC's Sahar Zand speaking with us from London. We have links to her reports about the mental health crisis in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.